step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Off Stage and On the Air, performance number 653. My name is Lisa Sheps. I am joined by my stalwart and cozy co-host, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello.
You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3, streaming live at koop.org. Please, please stay with us. We will be right back.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up.
I would just like to say that it is my conviction that longer hair and other flamboyant affectations of appearance are nothing more than the male's emergence from his drab camouflage into the gaudy plumage which is the of his sex.
It is Wednesday, January 26th, 2022. On the show today, we have the Malum Malice Burlesque, and we will have the first in a long series of interviews about longstanding theaters in Austin. And today we will hear part one of The Vortex. And of course, Nicole and I will have a very short conversation about the world of theater in New York, Austin, Chicago, and Pittsburgh. Don't go away.
That is the way things are in most species.
We were able to play the whole song. Are you there?
I hit the mute by accident. I love that song. I hit the mute because I was singing my little brains out while it was playing.
Excellent. Well, I will like to thank Mr. Kim Simpson for another wonderful International Folk Bazaar. I can never get enough didgeridoo and Australian yodeling.
Me neither. And I went and checked out a lot of that didgeridoo playing. I did not get Australian yodeling when I went to Australia, but I did get some didgeridoo.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you, there's an album that I had in the 80s that I love and still listen to on occasion called Dr. Didge. It's kind of rock and roll didgeridoo. So,
okay. That sounds like epically awesome.
It is epically awesome.
Send that to me so I can check that out. Like, tell me the name. I won't remember right now.
I will. We have a jam-packed show today. So we played My Conviction from Hair. Do you know why we played that?
Because of the meatloaf?
Because of the meatloaf. So Meatloaf was in Hair, and he played that role of the woman. I forgot what
Mary Sunshine.
No.
That's Chicago.
The woman didn't have a name. It was just woman. Anyway, he played that role. And of course, everybody knows that, I assume, because it happened last week after we aired, Meatloaf passed away. And my gosh, what a loss.
And, you know, he had a lot of stage credits, and he was doing a lot of the stage stuff before he was a giant rock and roll
guy. He started on stage.
Yeah.
And so obviously the Hair was in the late 60s. He originated the role of, I can't remember the name, in Rocky Horror Show.
Eddie and Dr. Scott on
Eddie,
stage,
right.
And then he just played Eddie in the movie.
And then, and he also did, didn't he do the original movie as well?
Yeah, he was in the movie, but he only did Eddie. He didn't play the doctor. He always said that it should have been a double role just like the play, and they should have done it in the movie.
And
like
he did Fight Club. He's done a lot of stuff, and his music.
The Rock and Hamlet musical. He did a Rock and Roll Hamlet musical, and he went in and filled in. John Belushi was really a good friend of his, and he went in and filled in on Broadway when John Belushi was in a show. I don't remember what
yeah,
show that,
that
was.
Well, that didn't show up on IBDB, but I'm sure you're correct. He was, do you know his actual real birth certificate name?
I did, and I don't remember anymore.
It's Marvin Lee Adday.
There you go.
And he took the name Meatloaf from the nickname that his evil children friends gave him.
Yes. My father had loved him. When my father passed, it's one CD we never took out of the car that we still keep in the car and played every once in a while thinking of Dad.
Amazing. Well, he will be missed.
We should also mention that currently still playing in the UK right now is Bad Out of Hell, the musical.
There you go. We should mention that. I did not realize it was still playing.
Oh, it's still playing. We just never got it in the US.
Well, awesome. We have a list of things to talk about, which we will not get to because we have so much content that we've pre-recorded that we're just going to get into a few things that we saw. And I will post on our show notes at offstageonair.com all the articles of things that we were going to talk about, but clearly are not going to get around to. But there was an off-Broadway production of Long Day's Journey into Night that just opened to really good reviews. And this was, Long Day's Journey into Night is Eugene O'Neill play, kind of autobiographical. It sort of talks about the time when he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. This is an updated colorblind version, and from a four-hour script, they condensed it down with the permission of his estate to 2 hours. And they kept things kind of contemporary. So the disease that Edmund, who is the Eugene O'Neill character, has is not really named. They never say tuberculosis, and leaves it to the audience to say, well, is it COVID-19 or is it tuberculosis?
What is it? Yes.
What I find interesting, I never noticed this. Are you very familiar with the play?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm just going to say, actually, no, I'm not.
So it's a...
I'm not going to pretend.
It's basically a four-person play, and it has Edmund, who is Eugene O'Neill, Tyrone, who is Eugene O'Neill's father, and Jamie, his brother, and Mary, his mother. And Mary is addicted to heroin? Cocaine, something. She's a drug addict. In the meantime, all the other characters are just swilling down alcohol, but only Mary's addiction is called as a problem. And I never really realized that. Yeah, all everybody else is they're drunks, and they don't consider the alcohol
a
drug.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
There were years ago when pregnant women were smoking cigarettes. We didn't think that
my
was that.
My mother was told that it made her it would help her pregnancy if she drank and smoked.
Yeah.
It was a very good review. Jesse Green made it a critic's pick, and I'm just going to read one paragraph of the review. And they're talking about how they've updated it to contemporary times instead of the, I think, the 20s or 30s when it was done. At first, the effect is humorous, as when James shows up in cargo shorts wearing Starbucks and Mary, demonstrating her improved health, does yoga. Soon, though, the jokes deepen, creating a feeling of the double vision we notice both our time and O'Neill's at once. The density makes a four-person play feel crowded. Clint Ramos's living room set, littered with discarded Amazon delivery boxes, nails the relentless clutter of self-indulgent family trapped together for months with no maid. And that's an interesting. It makes me want to see it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
I'm with you on that one.
Okay, well, I'm gonna just blast through and sort of talk about the things that we want to talk about. You had sent me all of a sudden. You had sent me last week a link about Banging It at La Jolla Playhouse.
Oh my gosh, I'm so obsessed with this.
And in the meantime, like 8 other people sent me the same link. And so Banging It is a play that it's either just opened or just opening at La Jolla Playhouse, and it looks amazing.
It does. So it's it's banging it is a play on words with Bhangra type of dancing in the Indian culture, which is the really fun, exciting, festive dance that you see a lot in Bollywood. They use a lot of Bhangra in there. I think it's from the Punjab region, but I think it was a harvest dance, if I'm correct. But it brings me such joy. And so it's a play on words. I think it's a clever play on words. And I am excited about it. I am just excited.
I hear that. So this is a piece. It's a new musical. It's called Bangin' It, a banging new musical with book by Mike Liu and Rena Lou Mizras, and music and lyrics by Sam Wilmot. Additional music by Deep Singh, and it's directed by Sanford Alma. And one of the things it says, it celebrates the traditions we inherit from yesterday and those we create tomorrow. It goes on to say, when a young woman finds her identity cannot be defined by checking a box, she sets off on a quest to dance to her own beat, drawing from competitive Bhangra and mixing it with other Indian and Western dance forms alike. Bangin' It, Banging New Musical, is an intoxicating, brash, and joyous musical for America today.
So cool.
So La Jolla Playhouse is oftentimes a jumping point for bigger and better things.
Yes, isn't that where the Thoroughly Modern Millie came from?
Lots of things came from La Jolla, but I'm not sure, probably.
I'm excited. I keep looking. I've Googled a few times looking for some video for some B-roll, and I haven't seen it yet. But I'm on the case because I'm excited.
Yep, me too. And you also texted me about, or sent me a link on this, and of course it's all over the place. So very ubiquitous, and it talks about the star of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
What's up with that?
His name is James Snyder. He was there was a complaint against him by his co-star on November 19th, and then he was taken out of the show at that point. And then they did a investigation and said that he is not invited back. She, in the meantime, has taken a leave of absence as well. They do not go into details about what it was, but they did say that they have a strict prohibition against harassment in any form. So, bum bum.
Yeah, I know. I was like, well, what? Okay. But he was not a good Harry Potter. He was a naughty little Potter.
Did you see him in it?
No, I'm just saying he's naughty.
Oh, he's naughty because yes, I get it.
That's not very good, little Harry Potter.
I get it. And really the last thing we have time to talk about today is the, it's a play, a musical called Harmony, written by...
Would that be like one Barry Manilow?
Barry Manilow, but it's not his music. It's original music. It's starring Chip Zinn and Sierra Bogus. And it...
Big Candor and Ebb folks. They do a lot of Candor and Ebb stuff.
It's interesting. By the way, it is directed by Warren Carlyle. They don't have any other casting. It has been delayed several times. I think we've talked about it on this show. But This tells the true story of the comedian Harmonists. Do you remember us talking about this?
Oh, we have. And I just know about it because I have a few friends that are giant fan of Lowe's, so I get Manilow updates at an epic proportion.
Well, the comedian Harmonists were not Barry Manilow. They were six men.
No, I know, but I'm saying I know all about it because Barry Manilow has been working on this. So I've been, I know more about this than I should. How about that?
Okay. They are six men in the 1920s in Germany. Both Jewish and non-Jewish, and they were basically singing together, showing harmonies. I actually have the Wikipedia of them as well. Where'd it go? I lost it. I lost the Wikipedia, which told me more about the... Oh, I'm so sorry. But it's an interesting group of people, comedian Harmonists. Here it is. They did Close Harmony Ensemble, and you're going to hear a little bit of them in a second. And they were working right before World War II. And they were just, I think, showing a lot of love and cooperation in a time where that really wasn't done.
Yeah.
So with that, we're going to go right to our first break before our next interview. We're going to hear the comedian harmonists in all of their splendor right this very second in a song called Mein Lieber Schatz, Bist du aus in Spanien? Take that, Kim Simpson.
I was just about to say, Lisa, that you said that all in one flailing swoop. I wouldn't have been able to do that. Go, Lisa.
Okay, here it is. We'll be back. We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa and Nicole. We're going to jump right into our first interview with Malin Malice Burlesque and their show about In Bulk. And you'll get all the details about all those words when we play this interview. So I'm just going to jump right to it. Here it is. Well, here we are in the Zoom room, and we've got here with us Blaise Ryson, who has got a burlesque cabaret opening up at the Vortex around In Bulk, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the festival.
No, you've got it perfectly.
Awesome. So, Blaise, tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is the latest installment of... our series of Malin Malice productions. We follow the Wheel of the Year. So all of the big holidays in witchcraft practices, most specifically like Western witchcraft practices. We started on Halloween for Samhain, and we're doing In Bulk next, which is like the idea of the holiday is it's like the first vestiges of spring are starting to appear. So
yeah, like which I found that kind of amazing. It always happens around February 1st and like, what? Spring? I don't think so.
The funny thing is it's like one of like the ways you tell is like the goats start lactating. So like that's like the one of the things, just fun little trivia. But this show is sort of structured in a way of we start with winter and we transition everything into spring at the end.
Oh, that's lovely. So you have you done your other productions also at the Vortex?
Yes, that's our home. So it's pretty much the next couple will be at the Vortex.
Well, I am so happy to learn about you because I don't think we knew about you before.
Yeah, I this is actually my first like round of producing. I've been doing burlesque for almost 10 years now. And like this is my first foray into producing and creating something from nothing.
Well, welcome. Isn't it fun?
I'm loving it. It's so much
fun. Oh, good. So from an audience standpoint, what can I expect to see when I come see the show?
Yeah, some fun, sexy striptease. We have some amazing burlesque artists that are joining us. We also have high concept dance. Basically, we blend like classical and contemporary dance with striptease.
Oh, great.
The concept is each one of our witches, their removals and their strips are spells that they're casting.
Uh-huh. And do you have any of our burlesque performers of note that we may know of? Do you want to tell us who's going to be performing?
Absolutely. Kitty Von Quim, who is absolutely lovely. We have Agatha Christie, who is our MC. She runs things. Myself, Carmen Take It, and a few newer performers, Sai and Fig, who are newer to the scene but are absolutely beautiful movers, as well as a bunch of others. So there are tons of wonderful people that I have.
So I've seen a lot recently, like in the past 5 years or so, a lot of burlesque that puts their burlesque performance and brings it in with aerial performance as well. Are y'all doing any of that?
No aerial quite yet. We're figuring out because we also we're doing like full set design as well. Like we're going more theatrical in nature.
Oh, great. Well, you know that. I love that.
Yes. We're creating a world, and right now we haven't quite figured out how to bring our aerial rigs into that world, but we're figuring it out for future. Well,
I'm thinking it might be kind of challenging at the vortex as well, unless you're outside.
Yes. Which, I mean, that would be a lovely thing to do, but well,
I get program credit if you end up doing that.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
So you say it's a theatrical, is it also, do you create a narrative?
Not so much a narrative, but a world. Like we kind of drop the audience in the middle of this. We, instead of a coven, we refer to ourselves as a chantry of witches. And you don't know how many there are of us. We just kind of appear in like random liminal spaces whenever it's time to act. And like all of us have sort of interactions, small interactions with each other. So it's like you're being dropped in the middle of a party where you don't really know anyone, but you're like figuring out what's happening.
So it sounds to me like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's not only is this performative, but it's also ritualistic.
Very much so, yes.
And so let's just say that I'm one of those like vanilla people that want to come and see a show and have a good time. Is there something for me there? Am I going to enjoy myself?
Oh, absolutely. We do our best to make it as accessible as possible. We try not to alienate by being too ritualistic. There's something for everybody. And at the end of the day, who doesn't like pretty people taking their clothes off?
True. True. Well, that is great. And what music are y'all using? Original music? Are you pulling music?
We pull music and we kind of cross the genres really. Everything from like Artie Shaw to Mazzy Star.
Oh, awesome.
Appearing in the show. So definitely something for everybody music wise as well. And it sort of is based off of our performers and like each one of our performers takes on a witch title, like witch of insert concept here, and kind of serves whatever they do.
Oh, well, that is awesome. So I know we have to talk about this because we're in the we're in COVID-19. We're in stage five. The vortex is not a huge space. What are y'all doing for COVID mitigation?
For COVID mitigation, we are requiring our audiences to be fully masked at all times. Ideally, socially distancing. The space is still small, so if anyone is planning on coming, just know that it is a smaller theater. Our performers are going to be are all fully vaxxed, boosted, as well. We'll have negative COVID tests, so like the performers on stage are not a risk either.
And but you are not you're not requiring it for audience members. They don't need to show a vaccine card.
No. If you would like to show it, that'd be absolutely lovely. And we would appreciate that. But
awesome. Well, it sounds amazing. We love the work that's doing at the Vortex. Where can folks go to find more information about this show?
You can find it through vortexrep.org. Tickets are available there, as well as you can follow us on Instagram at Malum Malice Burlesque.
Great. And where, we didn't say when is this happening? What's the dates? Yeah,
that's important.
That's an important.
We are there January 31st, February 1st, and February 2nd. So Monday, awesome. Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Well, it's right there at the, in bulk.
Yep, right there, and in the middle of the Lunar New Year as well.
We want that. Well, Blaze, it was so happy to have had you on. We'll have to get you back. Tell me what's next after this one for you.
After this one will be our Beltane show, and that'll be in May. So,
when you say Beltane, is that like I'm belting a song?
Beltane, B-E-L-T-A-N-E. It's the big like fire festival, and that'll be like probably our sexiest show that
rawr, of course. It's hot and it's on fire.
Exactly. Start of summer, so take it off.
Awesome. Blaze Ryson, thank you so much for joining us on Offstage and On the Air.
Yes, thank you for having me. Double,
toil and trouble. Cannot get away from Macbeth no matter how hard you try.
No, that was good stuff.
Yeah, that's a song called Witch's Brew from a show called Hallelujah Baby. And of those women singing, one of them was Leslie Uggams.
Oh.
Yeah, it was Marilyn Cooper, Leslie Uggams, and Barbara Sharma from, I don't know, I hadn't heard of this song, this show. So it was, I learned something. Well, so we've just got about, yeah, we don't have any time at all. We have about 5 minutes, but I do want to take a moment to talk about the other thing that you brought to my attention after I brought to your attention one show. And this is this show called Who Done It, which is across the pond. And very much like the show White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, the actors don't know anything about the show before they do it. They just get on stage and do it. And in the case of Who Done It, they're actually fed the lines through an earpiece in their ear.
Isn't that crazy?
And when they did it before, they had Ian McClellan, Emma Thompson, Harry Hill, Sanjeev Bhaskar, I believe... where is it? Some other really well-known people from this side of the pond. Matthew Broderick, I think, was one of them. And it sounds very interesting. And they play a detective.
And don't they get a whole bunch of really fun props too?
Yes. About 5 minutes before it starts, they bring the actor backstage and they get some props and costume pieces that they get to put on.
I just think that's so much fun. I just think the whole unexpected surprise of everything is just so much fun.
Yep. So they say they get a choice of coats, hats, mustaches, and wigs. I know you like your mustaches.
I do like my mustaches.
All right, we're going to go straight to Today in Theater History. You ready?
Da, 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 da. Today in theater history, Lisa's going to share what happened.
It is the birthday of one Paul Newman, who was born in 1925.
I saw him trending earlier, and I was like, oh, why? And then I realized it's the birthday.
Did you know he did Our Town in 2002?
I feel like I did, but I forgot, kind of, one of those.
Well, okay, 6 years later, the Theater Guild produces a show called Green Grows the Lilacs, starring Lee Strasberg, Tex Cooper, and Francois Tone. It ran for 64 performances. A decade later, they made it into a musical by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II.
Interesting.
Do you know what that musical is called?
I was just about to say, what was the musical called?
Oh, K-L-A-H-O-M-A, which was that, what people don't know is that was the original melody to that song.
Was that the original song?
In 1975, Albee's Seascape opened with giant talking lizards emerging from the sea to talk philosophy.
Interesting.
Very. And 1998 was the opening night of The Phantom of the Opera. Ba na 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 na.
The Phantom of the Opera.
It's amazing.
I have a love-hate relationship with that musical. I really just have to admit it now.
Yeah, I don't have a hate relationship. I have a dislike relationship with it, but I do love, and I've said this numerous times on this show, scenically, it's amazing. It's just the set. When it's done, it's beautiful.
There's some parts in it musically I love too. That's why I have my torn.
Well, let's go to something that I think you feel better about. This is the off-Broadway opening of the musical Rent, and a day after the death of the author, Jonathan Larson.
I have the program from that evening framed. In a big old frame.
There you go. You're the coolest. And in 2012, Cynthia Nixon starred in Manhattan Theater Club's Wit, which is a Pulitzer.
Well, that seems like it was way longer than just 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago. Other birthdays?
She liked it at even 20. Whoa.
What's that? What was that?
That means it's almost 20 years that Judith liked doing it, probably. That's like, whoa, I'm just realizing we're old, Lisa. That's all.
Okay. Speak for yourself. It's the birthday of Jules Pfeiffer, David Stratham, Celia Keenan-Bolger, and Michael R. Jackson, who was born in 1981. That's just amazing.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, so that's where we're going to stop right now for the majority. We're going to come back and we're going to hear Bonnie Cullum talking about The History of the Vortex, which I'm very excited to see. We will take this transition and listen to a little bit of the new version of Oklahoma. And, you know, because I'm just a co-host that can't say no.
I'm just a girl who
Okay, we're going to jump right back in. We're going to jump right into this interview because I don't want to miss any of it. We're going to be starting a series of interviews with people and learning about the longstanding theaters, how they got there, the people behind them, and things like this. This first one, we're going to focus on The Vortex and Bonnie Cullum, and this is going to be a two-part interview. First part is today, and we'll go through the history from the very beginning, and then next week we'll take part two. So let's just jump right into it. This is going to be the first of a series of pieces on longstanding theaters in Austin and where they came from, what they've been up to, what's the future and everything. And there's not a better way to start this with The Vortex, which has been part of my theatrical life here in Austin since I got here from the very, very beginning, the very first day. And we have here the one of the founders of The Vortex and the current producing artistic director, Bonnie Cullum. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's so wonderful to have you here talking about your theater.
Yeah, well, so pleased to be able to kick off this series and talk about our really 33 years of history in Austin,
which is amazing. I was trying to do the math in my head when I was looking at stuff today, and I was like 30. To me, my head went to 35 because I always round up. But that is amazing. 33 years, and you have been with them. You've been with The Vortex that entire time.
That's right. I'm one of the co-founders, and we founded the company for graduate students at UT, founded the company in 1988.
Right. And who are the other, there are four of you, correct?
Correct.
And who are the other three? And are any of them still involved?
No, not really. Long distance support. It's Steve Backer and Lorena and Sean O'Malley. And the O'Malleys are in Hawaii. Lorena is a tenured professor at University of Hawaii, and Steve is has dabbled in politics and social services and social work and occasionally theater, but he's on the East Coast. So I don't usually see them, but, you know, they've been gone a long time.
That's amazing. I just have, because I am a Hawaii file, what island are the O'Malleys on?
Oh, they are on Oahu. Yeah.
So are they in Waikiki, University of Hawaii, I guess?
University of Hawaii, yeah.
And are they involved in theater?
Oh, yes. Yes. She, Lorena is a tenured theater professor. She got her PhD in theater history from UT. And then Sean is actually a chemist, but he is a prolific musician, improviser, actor, director, and has been very active in the Honolulu theater scene. So
awesome. I have not apropos of this interview, but I have a very dear friend that lives on Maui and is very involved in the Maui theater scene there. Your first shows were done at Mexicarte.
Yes, Mexicarte downtown.
In the same location they're in now?
In the same location they are now. At that time, there was a sort of a second floor theater space, which eventually they quit producing in. But we produced actually all over that museum. We did Romeo and Juliet downstairs. We did Angels Are Waiting upstairs. And we did performance art upstairs. And then we did this production of Václav Havel's Temptation, which actually was a movable feast, and we moved the audience around through the whole museum to four different locations, four different playing areas. And my only memory, I did the costume design for that show, but my only memory of the actual production is hustling chairs. The audience would move to the next location, and we would go and take all the chairs because we had a limited number of folding chairs and move them to the other location that the audience was going to come to next. And then as soon as they vacated that one, we'd move the chairs to the fourth. Anyway, that's all I did the whole show was move chairs. during the production.
Isn't that amazing? So you could call yourself Eugene Ionesco as well.
Yes, it's true. That's true. The chairs.
So you have the mission or the your creative direction for Vortex has always been on the experimental, cutting edge side of theater. Is that correct?
That's right. And I think also with an edge of social activism in our work, that we've always pretty unabashedly taken on the various social political crises of the time and tried to dig into that and present theater that actually makes a difference. So I know that we have done some very safe and sane productions in our time of creating many hundreds of shows. However, I do think that it's not, I do think that we have not been as successful on those shows. Like, those are not the shows that people have loved. So, you know, it's like, yes, we did that. And also we have really been fortunate to be able to do a lot of new work, a lot of new plays, a lot of experimental work, a lot of multidisciplinary work, ritual theater, things that really challenged audiences in form or content. And I think those are the things that have actually done the best, you know. That
so now, when the four of you started, it wasn't called the Vortex back then.
It was. Yeah, it was. Oh, it was founded as Vortex Repertory Company. Okay. And we always referred to it as the Vortex. Our first space was, we used Vortex Repertory Company that first season. And then our first space was called the Vortex Performance Cafe.
Oh, okay.
And it was a 17,000 square foot movie triplex in Southeast Austin.
I can't wait to talk about that. I just want to put a pin in that for just a little second.
Okay, sure.
When the four of you got together to start this company, and I must say that we talk about the city of Austin and the theater community, you know, we always have somewhere, you know, around 100 theater companies. And I talk about that with the three major theater schools in this area, it's very common for people to come out of graduate school, a group of friends come together to put together a company, and oftentimes they fade out pretty quickly. But that was how you guys started, and you clearly didn't fade out. This question is two parts. How do you attribute your longevity? How did you, your base of theater, I'm assuming, helped keep that longevity? And how did the, when you first started, how did the four of you come up with what would eventually be the mission and driven organization that you are now?
Well, in the, when I moved to Austin in 1985, I think that the theater scene here was not really vibrant and was not as prolific as it is now. And most of the theater that was being done in Austin was a well-made play that had been published. Perhaps it was new, perhaps it was old, but it was not something that had been developed from scratch. Occasionally there'd be a new play competition or something like that. And that's really the work that was interesting to us, is what's new, what's different, what hasn't been done before, or what can we do in a totally new way with a totally new lens. And we were, Steve and I were going to New York quite a bit at that time during grad school, and seeing, we would go and, you know, go to the Village and see all the experimental theater companies, you know, anything that was going on at La Mama or whatever the Wooster Group was doing. Or
I was going to say, I guess the Wooster Group, which is actually in Austin right now.
I know. I'm so excited to see it. So, you know, we were going to Pina Bausch and Martha Clark shows and being influenced by the way that dance and movement were being used in experimental production. And so I knew that I wanted to do these sort of bigger vision pieces. And I was aspiring to that even when I was in graduate school, but the Vortex kind of gave us the platform and the permission to do that. And while we did still do a lot of plays in those early years, plays like with printed words on paper, we began a series of more workshop developed pieces and more experimental pieces that involved lots of different artists and lots of different voices and putting things together in new ways and doing a birthday party for Samuel Beckett that involved, like, I don't know, 50 different artists doing Beckett all over the place and stuff like that. So we were just trying different things. And I think along the way, I attracted a group of like-minded folk, which is kind of what we always wanted. And while the other founders moved away, the people who were kind of at the core of that group grew stronger and bigger. And we now have I have people in the company that I've worked with for 20, 25, 30 years. Or Tony Bravo, who was in the very first show, you know, he was in The Angels Are Waiting. So, you know, it's like Tony and I were colleagues in graduate school. We had offices across the hall from each other. So, you know, Tony is an original Vortexian. She was in the very first Vortex show. So there have been people who have stayed near the center or who have come back to the center. Maybe they moved away from Austin and came back. Or maybe they never left. Or maybe they had kids. Like I have whole groups of artists who've now raised kids and now they're like ready to do theater again. So this is very interesting in the life cycle of the company, kind of us getting together as 20 somethings. And then, you know, all these years later, now some people are still around. And that really combined with the fresh blood and the new folks who come in and the young people who come in create a real vibrant kind of creative hotbed that we're able to launch these new projects from. The company has evolved dramatically along the way, but the core of that sort of swirling center of the vortex, people joke that people get trapped in the vortex. They get caught in the swirling center and they can't get out. But I think that the people who really love it and the people who love working together have been pretty consistent. And even people who've kind of left or moved on to other places are still sometimes coming back and doing new work. So that's rewarding to stay connected.
Well, that's amazing. That's a tribute to what you created. And we're going to continue to talk about that. I want to talk about the move to the triplex. You found this space and in a triplex, I'm guessing there were three theaters in
yes.
there, if I'm doing my words right. Yes. So were all four of you still involved at that point?
Yes. And it was 17,000 square feet, and there were three theaters plus this enormous lobby plus a whole projection booth upstairs. So the projection booth upstairs, we actually, some of us moved into it and lived there to be able to afford the rent. And it was a crazy kind of time. I mean, to live in the theater at that time,
because yeah, we were. I can imagine, were you one of the people that lived there?
Yeah, I lived there.
So as someone who has opened a theater in Austin in the past 6 years or so, the idea of having the financial resources to rent a 17,000 square foot place is just beyond the scope of imagination. So I know that the financial situation in Austin was different in the 80s, but how could you afford such a place?
Well, we were lucky that the property, basically the movie theater that built it had moved out because they were going to expand Ben White. They were going to change it from, you know, a little 4-lane road to this big highway that it is now. And that was going to take out part of the parking lot, and movie triplexes they were no more. People were moving now to 10 and 12 and 20, right. 20 plexes. So the realtor who was handling that property happened to have minored in theater. So when we approached her about, hey, won't you give this scrappy little company a chance? I mean, she didn't like have a whole bunch of takers for that property. And there was a big recession in Austin, and there was just all this property sitting empty. And so she gave us a good deal with an escalating rent. The first 3 years, the rent would go up each year. But the caveat was that we were going to be on a month-to-month lease, and that at the time that they were going to tear down the building, they would kick us out. So it was not a terribly secure situation. And we really thought it was a good financial deal until we got those summer electric bills. And there were like 10 air conditioners that it took to air condition that whole building.
Sure.
So we developed a protocol where we would, you know, an hour before people were called, we would turn on the air conditioner in the given space that was going to be used, and everything else in the whole building would be shut off. Because I think that first $2,000 electric bill was like, oh yeah, this is what we're never going to make it here. You know? So even though the rent was low, the utilities were really high. And when you look at those early, I mean, this would have been 1990, 91, 92, 93, and we moved out in 94. The amount of work that we produced during that time was phenomenal. I tried to fill those three theaters all the time. I mean, two theaters. I tried to fill the two theaters all the time. So we didn't do much in Theater 2. It was mostly storage, backstage, workshop space, but we did do a few productions in there. And then we had this gigantic lobby, which I saw as eventually being a cafe situation, kind of like what we have at the Vortex now. I was going to develop it out and get a beer and wine license and have fancy food and stuff like that. That never really happened, but we did have robust concessions and we did fun concessions. And then we had events there in the lobby, like music and improv and poetry. And a lot of Austin great musicians played there early in their careers. Like, you know, Guy Forsythe was there at our early open mics, kind of, you know, just barely starting out. And, you know, it was a great kind of wild time. But when you look at the archives, the volume of work that we did in that time, I don't know how. We were much younger. So much,
exactly. Well, that's amazing. And then so that property was torn down and you found where you are currently, which, you know, for those of us that have been around a little while, and certainly the people that are just here now, the East Side right now is a thriving, it's very, very populated and gentrified, unfortunately. But when you bought that property, nobody was in that area.
That's right. Well, it was 94, in the summer of 94. And again, there's not really a robust internet situation. So I spent every night driving around Austin in my pickup truck, looking at for rent properties and writing down the phone number to call the next day to like go and see what was available. There was a lot of property available on the East Side, and we looked at several different properties, kind of seriously considering what we were going to do. And we could not get, we wanted to go in with other companies. We wanted to have several different companies come in with us and run a new space. And it was very hard to interest certain companies in that their boards weren't really interested in being on the East Side. It seemed too dangerous. Would audiences actually come to the East Side? They didn't know. And I was like, okay, y'all, I guess I'm just going to have to do this myself. I did get a couple of partners, small arts partners, when we first moved into the Vortex. And that first season, I had this big vision of this kind of complex that would be run by several different companies, and we would kind of divvy up the money and the responsibilities and stuff like that. But that's not what happened. So that warehouse, when I first looked at it, I thought it was impossible. It was 10 years abandoned. It was really not in good condition. It was not in it, you know, no air conditioning, no insulation, no restrooms. You know, I was like, it's just too much. And so then I went to New York on a job. And while I was in New York, I went to some theaters. I saw I saw Stomp in that little tiny theater. I saw the New Yorican Poets Cafe. Like, I saw these kind of funky spaces, and I was like, well, maybe that space could work. So I came back to Austin, and I looked at it again, and I brought some people with me, and we kind of visioned it and talked to the landlord, and he gave us a break because we would be putting a lot of money into the building. And so we did it. And I guess after 3 months, we ran out of 3 or 4 months, we ran out of money. I mean, it cost too much to do it. And so, you know, we were just that we could never have gotten away with what we did in 1994. Now it would just never have happened.
Right. So now, is it still the four of you at this point?
No, they're gone.
They're gone. Yeah. So it's you and your company and
a ragtag company of unpaid folks.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, really the whole thing is kind of held together with my will, and some, you know, hot glue and duct tape. You know, it was really not, it was not pretty. It was not elegant. And it was, I remember when my father came and saw the space, he was pretty horrified at what I had done. And my cousin George said, you know, if you open in a month, I'll eat my hat. You know, he was like, there's just no way. But we opened in a kind of, you know, real rough. We were, you know, we had porta potties. We had no air conditioning. We opened the big doors and gave everybody a hand fan, you know.
Which is amazing, and you take it makes me think that, you know, that's what the Museum of Human Achievement is right now, and, you know, possibly in 10 or 15 years that space will be reconditioned and different as well. So
I mean, you just have to, like, we literally were just holding on, you know. It was literally impossible what we were trying to do.
And who were you? So really, you were at the head of this, and you're, were there any of those core groups of ragtag artists? Are any of them still involved with the Vortex from that when you were reconditioning the building?
Not really. You know, there were a lot of people who worked really, really hard in those first couple of years. But there was very little money, and it really wasn't sustainable. And so most of them moved on and did other things.
Sure.
I mean, I did work very closely with Jason Amato, who was at that time, I think, 19 when we moved into the Vortex.
Can you imagine?
You know, he was very influential on my work as an artist. And, you know, even though he's moved away now, I feel like he is he's part of the paintbrush of my palette. And I feel like my work was so deeply shaped by people like Jason, who stuck around, and even though we didn't have the resources, figured out cool ways to do things and things that really made magic in the theater in a space that was so tiny. And, you know, we would create these big vision worlds in this tiny little black box, and people would come in and they would think that the theater was like twice as big as it really was, because it was so opulent and so spectacular and so magical. And they'd be like, wow, that's so incredible. And they'd come back another time when the theater was black box, and they'd be like, this space is really small. You know, it was a thing. But yeah, Jason was really important. There were a number of people who helped me build out the space who have moved on or no longer are doing theater or no longer live in Austin. So there's a lot of those people. But really around that time, I started doing these workshops. And I had started them at the old Vortex. I'd been inspired by a workshop that I took with Eugenio Barba to do this kind of new physical compression and expansion techniques, and to explore new material and poetic material in different physical ways. And so I had started working with small groups of actors when we were at the old Vortex. I used to teach like acting class, like normal acting class with like monologues and stuff. So I would do that. I would do that. And then for fun, I would have these workshops that were just for me, that were like my playground, where actors would come and we would play, and we would play with material and we would play with technique. And that's kind of how I started my time at the current space, was with these extended workshops. And we would meet every Sunday for 3 hours. And so it was like a spiritual journey for me to learn what the capacity was for a small ensemble to create work. And again, some of those people have died, you know, some of those people are no longer around. So it was also a time when we lost a number of company members to AIDS. So, you know, it was a very hard transitional time as we kind of moved forward in the new space and built it out and restructured everything. And again, it was pretty much just me and some work study students. Everybody else was volunteer. So, you know, there wasn't a staff, there wasn't any money. We got very little money from the city. We really didn't have any big donors. We really didn't have anything. And so it would be just this constant shifting of priorities, where it would be like, okay, so this is what it's going to take to do the show. So we got to do that. And this is what it's going to take to pay the electric bill. So we've got to do that. And I guess everything else is just going to have to wait. And then, you know, and then it went on like that for years.
1, 2, 3. Whatever happened to a Saturday night when the rest of shop and you felt all right? It don't seem the same since Cosmic.
Okay, we've pretty much done it. That was part one of the Vortex saga. Next week we'll have part two, where Bonnie talks about what's going on now, or the plans for the future. And it's a very, very interesting It was fun interview, and I'm looking forward to talking to the other theaters like Hyde Park and Austin Playhouse and Austin Shakespeare and some of the other theater companies and theaters that have been around for a long, long time. We are just about out of time. You can find links to everything we talked about and didn't talk about at offstageonair.com. Stand by for DJ Mark and Texas Music Mixtape. He's here. He's raring to go. It's like I can't. He's like trying to get to the mic right now, and I'm going to let him go ahead and do that. So we'll see you next week when we look at what's happening off stage and on the air. Bye.
I used to swim from the perfume I smelled. My hands kind of fumbled.